KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
This is not an office to promote a particular religion. This is an office to promote religious diversity and religious tolerance around the world.
If I were to mention all those who've shown me such wonderful generosity through Gone with the Wind, I should have to entertain you with an oration as long as Gone with the Wind itself.
The risk for Amazon is making sure they're not the fruitcake of tablets that just get gifted as a holiday gift and don't really have much traction the rest of the year.
I like the fruitcake tablet idea. That's Todd Bishop talking about the Amazon Fire, and we're going to hear more from Todd later this hour. Vivian Leigh receiving the Oscar for Gone with the Wind. She's would have celebrated her 100th birthday in this 2013. Robert Horton will talk about some of those centenarians. And Stephen Harper talking about Canada's newly created Office of Religious Freedom. From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scher is on vacation. British Columbia taxpayers may be on the hook for millions of dollars. A U.S. regulator says a BC Hydro subsidiary did commit market infractions, and those infractions drove up electricity prices. That was more than a decade ago. Joining us with details on this and more, including the odds for a Canadian Pope, is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. And Vaughn, let's start with this BC Hydro subsidiary.
Yeah, this is an old story,
yep.
Marcy, but it's still knocking around out there. If you remember Enron,
I do.
Remember the California power crisis of the year 2000. You had a bunch of they deregulated the market in California. There were brownouts. Power prices spiked in the spot market, and a bunch of utilities outside California were accused of manipulating the market to drive up prices even higher. One of those companies, Enron was the most famous, but one of those companies was a company called PowerX, which is a division of the government-owned electrical utility here in British Columbia, BC Hydro, and they made a lot of money off it. They made about $1 billion.
Uh-huh.
Ever since then, PowerX has been accused of taking part in Enron-style manipulations, and thus overcharging California consumers. And the U.S. regulator, FERC, has basically said guilty as charged.
I have to just stop because an Enron memo that was uncovered, 13, 14 years ago, described PowerX as hogs at the trough.
Hogs at the trough. As I said, they pulled in about $1 billion. In fact, they pulled in so much money that the government gave everybody in British Columbia $200 as a rebate on the profit taking. So here we are today, Marcy, and the federal regulator in the state says PowerX is guilty and the money has to be paid back. They haven't set the exact amount, but the indications are if this stands, and of course it'll be appealed, but if this stands, it's $265 million for starters, and it might be more than that.
Well, I had a question about the jurisdiction here. The U.S. regulator made this ruling, so is that binding in Canada?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, first of all, it's been going on for 13 years, and I think we'll be employing lawyers for many more years to come fighting this. We probably spent more on legal bills fighting it than it cost to settle it out of court, but that's a different issue. We want to sell our electricity into the American market. We have a surplus of electricity. In fact, we Canadians have a share of the electricity that is generated on the Columbia River because Canada helps manage water levels on the Columbia River.
Mm.
So part of the power that's generated by Bonneville Power, we sell to California rather than taking it back into Canada. So in order to operate in the American market, we have to operate by American rules, and an American regulator whacks us. We have to pay up because otherwise we wouldn't be able to do business down there.
So it's 13 years already of battle. You don't expect that any money's going to change hands anytime soon.
No, You know, our political parties here in British Columbia fight about pretty much everything, but on this one, they agree. The current government says the previous government didn't do anything wrong back in the year 2000 when this happened, and the opposition party, which was the government then in 2000, says they didn't do anything wrong either. So I think, as I said, you look in the fine print of the books at BC Hydro, you'll see they've allowed for $265 million or something like that on this. But as I said, their preference is that they never pay it.
Well, from one kind of interesting story to something completely different, the Harper government has picked a Christian college professor to be Ottawa's official watchdog for international religious persecution. What is this?
Our government, the Conservatives, promised to establish an Office of Religious Freedom, as they call it, which is essentially, it'll be part of our Department of External Affairs, our Foreign Relations Office, and will issue reports, monitor situations, and occasionally protest the treatment of religions around the world. Prime Minister asked, what's the purpose of all this, and he referred to persecution of Christians in China, persecutions of Muslims in China, Tibetan Buddhists, Falun Gong, throughout the Middle East, and so forth. It's a controversial move. I mean, it's popular with, obviously, with the base, and that's why they're doing it. I mean, their conservative base. I see as a background in one of the Canadian stories on this that Bill Clinton established an Office of Religious Freedom in the United States. I don't recall that, but perhaps one of the listeners can remind me if that office is still around.
Yeah, it's not something I remember. So the Harper government picked a fellow named Andrew Bennett.
Yes.
Who is this person?
Well, he's a fairly low-profile guy. It's a tough job to fill because the government wanted somebody who, you know, was of an academic nature and had an ability to research this kind of stuff and make statements about it, but they didn't want somebody who was going to be a firebrand, who was going to disrupt our trading relations with, say, China or Saudi Arabia or any place like that. So he is a former federal government bureaucrat, now teaching at a fairly obscure Christian college here in Canada. He is himself a Ukrainian Catholic, although I don't know as though that was a major factor. But he's not widely known as a human rights advocate in Canada. He is the dean of Augustine College, based in Ottawa, a Christian liberal arts institution.
Well, and so here's this human rights agency that's just been set up. Do you know why the Prime Minister didn't look to the usual human rights circles for somebody to fill this post?
I think he wanted somebody that was on the same page as he is, which is to say fairly conservative. And second of all, as I said, I don't think the Canadian government wanted somebody who was going to be so active that they would disrupt our trading relations, say, with China. As you know, China does not respond well to criticism in
no.
the international sphere, and they're a pretty big trading partner, so we didn't want to disrupt that.
But you just named off four instances of persecution that all
yes.
were in China.
Yes, I did, because here's of course the other thing, which is there is a complaint in Canada that I would say comes from the other side of the political spectrum, from the Prime Minister, that this is about picking on Muslims.
Mm.
It's about picking on religious fundamentalism in the Arab world, but only in countries that aren't sort of our allies. So this is the accusation was that the Prime Minister was picking and choosing in his targets on religious freedom, or alternatively, that mostly concerned about Christians because he has supporters on the Christian right. So I think that's why in interviews you've heard him say, well, you know, we're looking at places like China as well. This is going to be tough to have this thing be any more thing more than symbolic and optical,
mm-hmm.
whether it will actually accomplish any good. There's no question there's religious persecution around the world.
Sure.
Are you going to be even-handed? I mean, the one thing you mentioned Amnesty International. I mean, Amnesty International's reputation is not for playing favorites, right? They pretty much go after everybody.
Right. Right. It's interesting. Interesting that the Harper government decided that they were going to establish this in the first place. But we'll follow that. And while
with political parties, keeping the base happy is always an issue.
I do know that indeed. While we're on the subject of religion, I understand that two big British bookmakers are putting their money on the Canadian.
Yes. So I think they meet next week, right?
Monday, the cardinal conclave of cardinals, or the
yes.
papal conclave will meet, yes.
So two of the big British bookmakers are giving 7-2 odds that the next pope will be Mark Ouellette, cardinal from the province of Quebec, a very well-connected member of the church hierarchy. I think that he's the only non-European on the betting list. He does have a connection to Latin America. He ran a seminary in Latin America, speaks six languages, and hey, to Canadians, this really matters. He used to play hockey.
Oh, a hockey-playing cardinal.
We got deep roots in this country. Canada has, particularly in French Canada, there are a lot of Catholics. It's the largest religion in the country. We're not a huge church in global terms, but he's on the shortlist, Cardinal Ouellette, and I guess he even made it into Stephen Colbert. You know, Colbert was on the other night. He said that Ouellette would be too Canadian, too nice to be pope, too equivocal. A pope can't be vague and equivocal and nice the way Canadians are. They've got to be firm. So even the comedians are having a bit of a fun with this one.
Well, I know that Pope Benedict, before he became the pope, I believe, was called God's Rottweiler. So you're telling me that Cardinal Ouellette is not a Rottweiler type of person?
Yeah, poodle maybe, lapdog, I don't know.
I think if you make it to...
He hasn't been around long enough to get a nickname. There's been a lot of coverage of this in Canada, and I notice in the international media that Cardinal Ouellette usually shows up on the list. I don't follow it closely enough to know, and I know there are many people of the Catholic faith that regard all this media speculation and bookmakers and everything is kind of vulgar and inappropriate. So, we recognize all that, but there is a lot of speculation about this, and there's been a lot of coverage in the Canadian media that puts this guy on the shortlist.
Well, he would not only be the first Canadian pope, he'd be the first non-European pope. And the articles I've read have been talking about Africa and Asia.
Yes.
So,
yes, you're right. I sort of assumed that, Africa or Latin America, but I guess the reason the more conservative odds makers are looking to Cardinal Ouellette is he is from the New World. He does have a connection to Latin America because he ran a seminary there, and he speaks Spanish. And he's very closely tied into the church hierarchy, so they would not be reaching way outside the church establishment if they picked him. So he offers, I guess you'd say, the best of both worlds. He is from the New World, but he is also well plugged into the church hierarchy.
So I know that as soon as a name is brought up, that it's more than Stephen Colbert who's doing a little
yes.
bit of digging. Cardinal Ouellette is elected to Pope, what does that mean for Canada and its Catholics and for the Cardinal himself?
I think Canadians would be just surprised and astonished. Pope Benedict never even visited Canada, right? I mean, John Paul was here, but and there are a large number of, there's 12 million Canadian Catholics, but we're a more secular country. We're not, not known for being one of the more conservative Catholic countries in the world. So I think it would be, Canadians would be pleasantly surprised. It's interesting that somebody from around the world, but I wouldn't say he represents the mainstream of Canadian society, except that most, the largest religion in the country is Catholic.
Well, Vaughn, it's fascinating to me, the whole process of choosing a new pope, and they say it's going to be done before Easter, so we'll keep our eye on that.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for being with us.
And you can put money down with the British bookies if you want to, you know.
I could.
Seven to two, that's not bad odds.
Vaughn Palmer's columnist for the Vancouver Sun. We talk with him every Wednesday on Weekday. We'll see you next week.
Movie stars at 100 in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Annie Wright Schools. The day school serves boys and girls in preschool through grade 8, while the upper school offers all girls day and boarding programs for grades 9 through 12. Annie Wright is an international baccalaureate world school. More at a-w.org.
45 degrees in Seattle and mostly cloudy. Microsoft's new web browser comes with a do not track default setting that makes it controversial among advertisers, but could make it popular with users. More about that in 20 minutes.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
One of the treats will be to talk to Robert Horton, who reviews films for the Herald and Everett, for us, for many years at Weekday, KUOW.org. Also blogs at the Crop Duster and helps put on interesting events at Fry Art Museum, talks about issues with Humanities Council and all sorts of people of Washington. You are a busy man.
I am. What am I doing here?
By the way, we are almost at the 20th anniversary of Weekday.
Ah.
Dave, Marcy, and I, starting it in 93. I believe you were part of that.
Yes, I think I was.
Pretty crazy,
That's
huh?
That's kind of odd.
Yeah. Well, we are odd. 20 years. You don't look a day over, you know.
Easy.
You were thinking about, and this is a fine time to talk about, 20 years. You wanted to talk about 100 years, which I look forward to also. The 100-year anniversary of Weekday.
That's going to be great.
Robots will be doing our work then.
Yeah. I don't know what it is, but we humans do like to mark off anniversaries, and the 100th anniversary is a big one. If you're talking about centenaries of people, of course, they're probably not still around, and that allows us. So, you know, by implication, we're looking back, we're setting people in perspective, thinking about something that's in the past. And I just decided to look at some movie people who might be having their centenaries this year.
By the way, Kirk Douglas, alive or dead? Still alive?
He is alive.
Yeah, he's pretty old. He could
make it. Yes.
That would be cool.
But he could kick the ass of many young action heroes, I'm convinced. He's in his
excellent
90s, but Kirk Douglas is Kirk Douglas.
Yeah. All right, well, one of his partners in crime for many years, Burt Lancaster.
Yes.
100. Would have been 100 this year.
He was a 1913 baby. Yeah.
I was watching some Burt Lancaster. I've been having a little spate of runs of Burt Lancaster, including very interesting Burt Lancaster, Kirk Douglas film noir, where Douglas is a gambling club owner and Lancaster comes back from prison or the war, interchangeable.
Yeah.
And tries to reestablish himself in the city. He is a force of nature. Burt Lancaster.
He's an unusual person. Yes,
but he lives on the screen.
Yeah, no. He had a very unusual quality, and I thought about him. And you know, one thing that was unusual about his career is that he didn't get into movies until he was kind of well along in life. You're talking about the late 1940s, mid 1940s as his entree into film. I think The Killers was his debut.
The Kubrick film.
The Killers, based on the Hemingway short story.
Oh, that's right.
That was kind of a classic noir title, and he was already 40 years old.
He had done a lot of acrobatic work, circus work.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It kind of come up in circus, and he was in many of his films. You can't miss the fact that he's an athlete. He brings a very robust, energetic, athletic aspect to so many of his performances, and even his gesticulations. He had a very distinctive way of standing on the ground and framing space with his hands, and he looks like someone who's maybe in the middle of a three-ring circus. He's just playing it to the hilt, you know?
I think that's very funny that he's already in late 40s or 40s when he comes on the scene, because he is one of those icons of Hollywood. He's like in the Warner Brothers cartoons. He's People are always doing impressions of him, always had impressions about him, but he wasn't a contemporary. I mean, he wasn't coming up at the same time as Henry Fonda or Jimmy Stewart or Clark Gable or those guys, huh?
Yeah, he was a little bit behind that group. I guess he must have been slightly younger than 40, but he was older than most actors are when they kind of become popular. And he became popular right away. The Killers was a success, and some of these other noirish titles that he was in, and he did some swashbucklers that did well.
Well, they needed him, didn't they, Hollywood? He was a younger, I mean, We're seeing it happening now, right? When we watch these Stallone and Schwarzenegger movies, then you think, oh, they need a Jason Statham or even the Channing Tatum, whoever the next guy is.
Bring the next guy in, and Lancaster had an unusual call for a guy who could be so forceful. He played a lot of roles that were kind of passive.
Like which ones?
Including the Killers, actually. It begins with him as a, he's the victim of this hit. And he kind of just, when the Killers come in, he just kind of says, you know, this is it. He doesn't put up a fight, just kind of rolls over in bed and takes it. And then you see what happens to him in the rest of the movie and how he got there. And he is kind of a passive pawn in things. And Lancaster occasionally liked to explore that role. But then, of course, he could also play Elmer Gantry, which is one of my favorite performances of his in the Sinclair Lewis novel, where he's the kind of fraudulent preacher who puts it over everybody. And that was just, you know, that allows him to really just spout off. And
now, was he ever accused, you know, was he accused of chewing the scenery or overacting, or did people accept him in these larger-than-life performances?
Yeah, I think if you look back at the time, I think there was a sense that he was a little hammy. You know, maybe there were serious actors, and then Burt Lancaster was a big, good-looking guy who could go big when the role called for it.
Did he ever play villains? Any roles?
He did play a few in movies. He played a few later in his life as well. Nothing's coming to mind at the moment, but he could do that. He was good at playing people who had some kind of ambivalence about them, certainly. He liked to explore that. He was, his role in From Here to Eternity, which is probably one of his best-known roles, is both kind of a conventional military heroic type, by contrast, especially to Montgomery Clift's more offbeat person, and yet also someone who has a very ambivalent relationship with the military as he's experiencing it.
Did he win any Oscar?
He did win the Oscar for Elmer Gantry.
Oh, for Best Actor.
Yeah,
huh?
At that time he'd been knocking around for, about 15 years or so, almost in Hollywood. So he was, in a way, he was almost kind of due. But he's had a life of unusual projects, along with the big star things. Sweet Smell of Success is an offbeat film. I guess he's a villain in that, right?
He's not a nice man. That's right.
All.
He plays the gossip columnist. Tony Curtis is Tony Curtis has to be as a toady.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. He was he did some work in Italian cinema, which seemed to mean a lot to him. He was in The Leopard by Luchino Visconti, and he just kept going. He was, according to most people, a somewhat prickly person to work with. He may not have been the happiest person, but some of that prickliness came across in interesting ways too in movies.
Big liberal. Big opponent to McCarthyism. Yeah. He was an interesting character. Yeah. I loved him in Atlantic City.
Oh, yeah. That was a great valedictory performance.
All right. Who else are you thinking about? Francis Farmer.
Now, hey, local connection. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
How many movies did she end up even making?
Not a lot. She did not make a lot of titles, and she certainly did not make very many good movies. She knocked around Hollywood before becoming disenchanted with Hollywood, which I don't think took her very long. And eventually Hollywood got disenchanted with her as well. Although she's luminous in a movie, Come and Get It, in which was directed mostly by Howard Hawks. And you can see why there was initial excitement about her if you watch that movie from earlier in her career, because she is just smart and quick and funny. And, of course, she's gorgeous. And it was, largely she had some emotional problems or mental problems that took her down into a rabbit hole for a while, and she came out of it, but certainly did not repair her career as an actress in a way that would be Give her a lot of prominence. It's a very sad story.
Her first movies were 1936. That's very interesting.
Yeah, I think Come and Get It dates back to that
36,
as well. So
yeah.
like we're saying, it's her centenary, and she was just coming of age then, and well, she was an unusual person, a young person. She wrote as a high schooler, I think she wrote an essay about the Soviet Union that ended up allowing her to visit the Soviet Union. She was an unusual human being who kind of ran aground at a certain point.
Now, how does she? Well, let's not compare, but along another contemporary of hers was Vivian Leigh, who had a much bigger career, right? Also, would have been 100 this year. Huh?
Yes. And also struggled with mental stability throughout her life. Yeah, yeah. Vivian Leigh, of course, plucked from relative obscurity to get the role of Scarlett O'Hara, her Oscar-winning role in Gone with the Wind, and instant, everlasting fame just because of that. And but after that, you look at her filmography. Not that many titles for someone who was as beautiful as obviously talented, and had as much celebrity as she was handed. With that movie, she certainly did not seem to be very interested in celebrity, because she went her own way.
She was portrayed in the contemporary film, right? My Week with Marilyn, right? Wasn't she Olivier's?
Yeah, she was married to Laurence Olivier for many years.
And so she was the character in that movie who was meeting Marilyn and had this sort of interesting reaction to her stardom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
She was a little standoffish in that film. I mean, the character.
Yeah. The implication that she'd been through the mill already with all of that business. Yeah, her marriage to Olivier was a long one and very fraught. And by most accounts, Olivier was had some kind of caretaker thing going on with Vivian Leigh through her ups and downs as a person.
So Leigh and Farmer, which movies would you recommend for people thinking about her 100 years old?
Well, Frances Farmer, really the only notable one that is of the ones that I've seen is a complete success is Come and Get It. But Vivian Leigh, along with Gone with the Wind, and of course Streetcar Named Desire, I would mention That Hamilton Woman, a film that was from the early 40s with Olivier. And it's got another title too. Is it called Lady Hamilton? But it's a film in which Olivier plays Lord Nelson. And it's really it's a historical film, but it's very much a love story. And it's one of those great studio era love stories that is just kind of lush. And it's got these two people who are just in awesome form. And whether or not some of their real life, magnetism really affects their performances, they certainly seem to have quite a bit of magnetism going on. And it's a film that's not, it doesn't come to mind automatically when people talk about classics, but probably should be a classic. It's a totally, totally satisfying movie.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, it's really a good one.
All right, a couple other people you're looking at for their centenary, Robert Horton, film reviewer, writes for the Herald, talks to us. Trevor Howard. Trevor Howard does not, did he have starring roles early on?
Yeah. Yeah.
I only see him as that sort of older man who looked like he'd had a life. His face had a life.
Yes. By every account, Trevor Howard was friendly with the bottle. And by the time he got into character actor stuff in the 70s and 80s, you definitely could see it in his face. He wore it. But he always had an interesting face, though. I'll say that. Looking at his filmography, Brief Encounter came along fairly early.
1946.
And I happened to watch that again recently, and I think it's a superb film. Famous David Lean directed Noel Coward scenario. And Trevor Howard and Celia Johnson play people who meet and they can't have an affair because she's married and he's married. And but it's a brief encounter, and it's a wonderful film, and he plays it beautifully. And people will, of course, remember him from The Third Man as well, in his encounters in the wide open Vienna of post-war. And he was great at playing that British character who's could be good or could be bad or could be sort of in between. Could be a little stuffy, perhaps, or could be a wilder version of that character.
He'd also be fun to look at all his various films and just see the range that he had.
I think, yeah, if going on a Trevor Howard kick, because he lasted a long time.
Yeah, all these are Anglos here lasting a long time here right now. Trevor Howard, and Vivian Leigh, I guess Farmer and Lancaster.
And what about Peter Cushing?
Peter Cushing, huh?
Another 1913 baby.
Wow.
So the Brits were really doing it, and Peter Cushing... Starting his career and coming up through, perfectly normal roles. He played Osric in Laurence Olivier's Hamlet, for instance, was one of the early things that he got noticed by. But by the time the late 50s rolled around, he became the Peter Cushing that Peter Cushing fans know and love, which is association with Hammer films and the horror movies that they made. He played Frankenstein, the Dr. Frankenstein, in Hammer's big Frankenstein reboot of the late 50s. He played Van Helsing in the Dracula series that they did there and many other movies, often in tandem with Christopher Lee, his partner in horror. Christopher Lee played the monster in, Frankenstein and so on, and played Dracula.
Are there movies that you would recommend, like those two guys together or alone, Peter Cushing, that really you enjoyed? Were fun, I guess. Maybe these.
Oh,
reboots.
Lots of them. Yeah, those two. I mean, the titles are. They had to retitle them. So, Horror of Curse of Frankenstein and Horror of Dracula. If I got that right.
The Curse of Frankenstein, The Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas.
That's actually a pretty good one.
Is that right?
That's a fun one. Yeah.
Alexander the Great. Well, he didn't play Alexander, I imagine.
I don't think so.
John Paul Jones. I've seen that.
And he stuck around. Cushing stuck around. And
Star Wars. Don't forget he was in Star Wars.
Hey, well, no, not at all. Not at all. That gave him a whole new, generation of fans. And
Grand Moff Tarkin.
Yeah, he's significant in that. He had that great kind of skeletal face, which was perfect for playing men of dubious repute. But by all accounts, I think everybody who worked with him thought he was just a lovely guy and a complete professional. And He's hung around long enough to kind of spoof his own image in the movie Top Secret that was made by the airplane guys.
Oh, really?
A hilarious, spoofy film. And Peter Cushing proves himself to be a very good sport by participating in that. But, it's kind of a wonderful presence in a certain sort of movie of that era, especially the 50s and 60s.
No, I'm looking at the Wikipedia, so take everything with, check it twice. But he was a painter, watercolors. Colorist. He did a children's book, Lewis Carroll style humor, the Bois Saga, B-O-I-S, Bois, Bois. And he was a patron of the Vegetarian Society.
No, I did not know that. Okay.
That's very interesting. All right.
Maybe being playing Dr. Frankenstein will do that to you. You don't want to be around flesh.
One last centenarian, which you must have met. Stanley Kramer, because he was here for a long chunk of time.
He was. He lived in Bellevue, and he did intros for Channel 13 back those days. I don't think I ever did meet Stanley Kramer. I may have seen him. Oh, he must have spoken at the film festival once or twice.
I'm sure.
Like,
I interviewed him once.
Did you? Yeah.
I have to look it up. Yeah. It was back in the 90s.
Yeah. A guy who, before he came out here, had a long career as a producer and director, especially associated with sort of social concern issue film things and movies that have in film history, they've kind of taken their place as having more importance, let's say, as social issue things rather than the artistry involved. But he made Inherit the Wind, and he made Judgment at Nuremberg, and On the Beach, which is kind of a haunting film, I find, actually, that movie about atomic Holocaust, 1959 or so.
It's a mad, 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 mad world.
Yes. He also,
did
that
I get
was
enough
like,
in
the,
there?
Like the one break he took, I guess, in his quest to make important films of social significance.
That's right. He did Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah, that was his. Worked a lot with Spencer Tracy, including Mad, 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 Mad World, and produced a bunch of films beyond the ones that he directed as well. And apparently, an energetic fellow who made his place in film history for a while there, put his stamp on things.
Well, you have to give him some credit. 23 different actors and Oscar-nominated performances that he produced and directed. Jose Ferrer, Gary Cooper, Maximilian Schell, Katharine Hepburn. So he must
all
have had
won.
Some skill.
Yeah, he stuck around for a while, and he was not a director of subtlety, I would say. he put out these things and let the chips fall where they may. The Defiant Ones just came to mind. I was going to mention that one too. Race relations film, the film from the 50s. In some ways, it's kind of easier to appreciate him now that you don't have to be a film critic and kind of wince at some of the more awkward moments in his movies, because you can say that he did help push the envelope a little bit, maybe with some of these issue films, and who knows what sort of difference he might have made in the final judgment.
All right, Robert Horton, fun to think about these folks who would have been 100 in 2013.
Happy birthday to them, I guess.
Happy birthday to them, and let's watch their movies. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Steve.
This is Weekday.
Film critic Robert Horton talking with KUOW's Steve Scherer. Todd Bishop of tech news site GeekWire is here to tell us about Microsoft's new web browser, which features something new and different. That's in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Every day, KUOW keeps you connected to people, places, and ideas that matter. Your financial support makes everything you hear on KUOW possible. You may have recently received a special appeal in the mail. Please mail in your gift today or give online at kuow.org. Your support right now will help keep our upcoming spring pledge drive on target so we can return to regular programming sooner. Thanks.
I'm Marvin Olney. On the next To the Point, the Voting Rights Act may be the crown jewel of the civil rights movement, but its most controversial section is being challenged this week in the U.S. Supreme Court. Is it time to let the South off the hook? Are new laws keeping racial discrimination alive? We'll hear the arguments next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.
That's this morning at 11.
KUOW and Evergreen City Ballet present Tea for Ruby, an original ballet for children at multiple venues March 2nd through the 30th. Illustrator Robin Price Glasser from the Fancy Nancy book series will sign books at the Maidenbauer performances March 2nd and 3rd. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
46 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle. It's 10:41. Florida Governor Rick Scott telling the president, "If your administration fails to do its job to responsibly manage the budget, thousands of Floridians will lose their jobs." He's referring, of course, to the impending budget cuts known as sequestration. More on that in 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scherer. Every few weeks on Wednesdays, we get to talk about the technology world. Todd Bishop, the co-founder and national editor for the online journal GeekWire, is here. And I know that it's tech time because I've got paper and a pen and you have a laptop. So welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Marcy.
It is great. So as Bernard just said, we're going to talk about a new edition for Windows 7 of Internet Explorer. This is IE10.
It is IE10. You've got Google and Firefox having astronomical version numbers at this point. Microsoft is still at 10.
So this came out already on Windows 8, and this is a retroactive upgrade for Windows 7?
That's right. Microsoft released Internet Explorer 10 with Windows 8, and now they're expanding it to effectively a much larger audience with Windows 7. Windows 7 at this point runs on the large percentage of PCs out there.
Right.
And so it's a big move for a lot of people out there.
So how is this edition of Internet Explorer different from what I've got on my computer now?
Yeah, one of the main things is under the hood, and that is a feature called Do Not Track. Now, this feature is in other browsers, mm-hmm. but the key thing that Microsoft has done here is turned it on by default in Internet Explorer 10. So you don't have to make the active decision to turn on this Do Not Track feature.
And so this is some, if you don't have this. This
yes.
is the all the data stuff that allows advertisers to find all your information, who you are, your demographics, so that all those little ads that fly up on
right.
the side come your way.
That's right. So if a lot of times people will notice nowadays, especially they'll browse on one site, they'll go to another site and they'll see an ad that's clearly targeted to them based on the site they just visited.
Yeah.
And so this Do Not Track feature is essentially a standard that's there that sends a signal to those advertisers that says, hey, I don't want to be tracked. Now, the thing is, it's not mandatory for the advertisers to pay attention to that signal. And that's actually what we're getting into here with Internet Explorer 10.
So they send that signal And that's like the do not call list
type
of thing,
exactly.
And which only lasted, it seemed like, 2 months at my house, and then they started calling again. So if I had this Internet Explorer 10, and theoretically it'll be upgraded for my Windows 7 platform, I have it. The advertisers choose to obey it?
That's right. It's essentially opt-in for them.
And okay.
So that is actually the fascinating thing here. Microsoft is rolling out a default option with Internet Explorer 10 that is at odds with the vast majority of the advertisers out there.
Sure.
And the irony here is, you know, Internet Explorer back in the day was the centerpiece of the government's antitrust case against Microsoft back when Internet Explorer had upwards of 90% market share
right.
on Windows. And now you have Microsoft, after Internet Explorer's market share has plummeted, it's basically half of what it used to be, doing the right thing for the little guy. So it's amazing how the tables have turned here.
Is this a marketing ploy by Microsoft?
Yes, yes. Now, that's a
he says right off the bat.
That's a cynic's view of it. I mean, clearly there is some element here where they're saying, hey, we want consumers to look to Internet Explorer as a product that's on their side. You know, Microsoft is facing very stiff competition, not only from Mozilla, Firefox, mm-hmm. but increasingly these days from Google, Chrome, which frankly is a bigger threat to Microsoft competitively. And so Microsoft is saying, okay, all right, we will turn this on by default. We don't care if it makes the advertisers angry. And they've really stuck to their guns, even as a lot of the major advertisers have come out against this.
That's interesting to me. It seems like, although it's going to sound really odd when I say it, but that Microsoft, once the behemoth, the subject of antitrust suits, is now struggling on many fronts to play catch up.
They are. If you look at things like Windows Phone, you know,
yes.
Microsoft with its former Windows Mobile platform had very healthy market share on things that we called pocket PCs mm-hmm. back in the day,
In the olden days.
That's
yeah.
right.
5 years ago.
And Windows Phone, the new generation of that, is in the single digits and struggling. So you've seen a lot of change in behavior in Microsoft.
And the Surface?
Yeah.
As well. There's two Surfaces.
There are. There's the Surface RT, as they call it, which is more like an iPad, and then the Surface Pro, which is more like a computer.
But in the meantime, while the Surface is happening, Microsoft put money into Barnes & Noble's Nook.
Yes.
Which is that not a competitor for the Surface, or am I not understanding this?
It's not a direct competitor.
Okay.
The Nook does have some tablets in its lineup, but primarily, it comes from the e-reader world, and people associate it with reading. Microsoft last year invested $300 million.
Yeah, a lot of money.
Yes, a lot of money. Well, everything's relative.
Maybe not for them.
Yeah,
it was a lot for me.
Yeah, they spent $1.2 billion on the company called Yammer, which a lot of people know is sort of a Twitter for businesses. But Microsoft did spend $300 million, put it into Barnes & Noble. And now Barnes & Noble, the Nook business, is really struggling. They've had a hard time keeping up with Amazon and the Kindle.
Well, and the Nook was specifically an e-reader, and you said, well, it's not quite the same, but it seems that those were the world of tablet and e-reader with Kindle Fire have merged.
That's right. Now, keep in mind, Microsoft is not only making hardware, but it's still, as its primary business, making Windows and operating systems. So the conspiracy theory, at least when Microsoft invested in Barnes & Noble, was that they would try to replace Android on the Nook with Windows.
I see.
So there's all sorts of subtle strategic things happening behind the scenes.
But Barnes & Noble may be pulling away from the Nook?
Yeah, there's all sorts of things happening with Barnes & Noble where they're talking about the one of the key executives purchasing the retail stores. Barnes & Noble says they're still going to be making the Nook, but another conspiracy theory here is that Microsoft could step in and take over a larger chunk of the Nook business and try and use that in that way to try and help Windows.
And how much of the market does Amazon's Kindle have at this point?
You know, there's a variety of different estimates. It's the vast majority.
The vast majority. That's all we need to say.
It's the dominant player for sure.
Well, so let's move from the PC-ish world over to the Mac world. And you have been writing about something called the Apple Smart Watch.
Yes. Yeah, there is a Microsoft tie-in here as well.
Oh, okay.
You know, back in the day, it was probably 10 years ago, Microsoft came out with this technology called smartwatches and smart personal objects technology. And they used FM radio signals to deliver lightweight data to your watch. Now, there's been some Apple patent filings recently.
Of course.
Yes, where they're talking about and looking at not receiving signals for the watch from the air, from a broadcast situation, but from your phone. So when you get a text message, for example, it would come in on your phone and then be transmitted by Bluetooth or Wi-Fi to your watch. So,
but I have a phone. Why do I need my watch?
Say you're in a meeting or the phone's in your pocket. It's meant to be a little bit more glanceable. Now, I should be careful to say Apple has not confirmed this. They've just made the patent filings, although New York Times and a few others have reported that they're working on it.
So I'm looking at my, I actually wear a watch, but I notice that anybody under the age of 18 does not wear a wristwatch.
Now, I haven't worn a watch in, 5 years.
Because you use your phone.
Exactly.
So
there's a real question about whether this could
work. So let me just say that if this is targeted at people who wear watches, most of us are over a certain age and we can barely see the text messages on our phone without our glasses. How are we going to see them on our watches?
Exactly.
I digress here, but I really think that some of these software developers need to bring in old people to just beta test on us because we can't see.
It's absolutely true. And I think there's a real question about whether this could be a viable technology. That said, if they can do something that's cool that perhaps younger people like, if there's any company that could bring back the watch, it's Apple.
We're talking with Todd Bishop, who is the co-founder and national editor for the online journal GeekWire. And while we're on the subject of Apple, which is losing its phone shares, as I understand, it's been surpassed by
Android.
Android,
yes,
at this point in time. Is that because of the death of its founder? What is the reason?
I would put that more on Android and the availability of cheaper Android devices around the world. You've really seen Android smartphones take off a lot in developing countries. The real question with Android is whether they can develop a strong app ecosystem. The key with the iPhone right now is that it's the water cooler device. It's the device that you talk about around work. Android users tend not to be, this is a gross generalization.
So don't call us that.
Yes, they tend not to be as engaged on the whole with the whole app world. And again, that's probably not true of half the Android users out there.
So does Windows, the Windows phone have its own app world?
It does.
How many apps are there for Windows phones?
Gosh, they just came out with a number this week, and I believe it was 120,000 or 130,000. So they're playing catch up. You know, they're hundreds of thousands behind Android and Apple. And I have a Windows phone. I actually made the switch from an iPhone at the end of the year, more as an experiment to see if I could do it. So far, so good.
Yeah.
But the problem is that the apps tend to come out first, and the cool apps, the ones that everybody's buzzing about, come out first on iPhone. Then they come out on Android, and then 6 months later, you see them on Windows Phone.
So the app developers are starting with the biggest platform.
Absolutely.
And, well, that
makes sense.
It does make sense. Todd Bishop is with us, as he is every few weeks, and we're talking technology. And we've been talking about cool or sort of space age gadgets, as we used to say back in my day. But an interesting announcement from the world of journalism. This week, the editor, I guess he's the editor, David Boardman at the Seattle Times, wrote a little column on the second inside page. It wasn't even on the front page of the Seattle Times, saying that the gray lady was going to institute a paywall.
That's right. Yeah, the Seattle Times really trying to turn back the clock in some ways. And it's basically following the same model as the New York Times. Mm. It's going to be fascinating to see how this turns out.
Well, the New York Times, when it announced its paywall, had a price right there in the announcement, I believe, and they gave everybody a 99¢ for a month and then upped the price to $20. And it was right in that initial announcement. David Boardman's column did not mention any details, really.
No, it didn't. We ended up writing on this on GeekWire and got the information through a Seattle Times spokesperson. And it's essentially going to be $4 a week for the standalone version, which is annualized quite a bit of money. It's more than $200 a year. They were careful to say that they will offer specific discounts, and you need to just basically keep checking the website.
Well, you could, if I read it correctly, those of us who subscribe to the newspaper, will have access. That's the same with the New York Times. You could subscribe to just the Sunday Seattle Times and still get online. So I'm not sure if they're going to charge more for that Sunday Times, because why would you pay for the whole thing if you buy one day and then you can get it all for free?
The pricing situation seems very fluid. I get the sense that they may be doing some experimentation at the very beginning to see what resonates and what doesn't.
What does is this something that you're seeing other online newspapers around the country doing? And the Seattle Times is Johnny Come Lately?
I don't know if they're Johnny Come Lately. They certainly are a little bit later in the process. But yes, definitely, this is the trend among newspapers. And of course, you know, my colleague John Cook and I come out of that world.
Sure.
We're reporters for the Seattle PI for many years, and so it's something that we watch closely. Not just as people who watch the tech industry, but as veterans of the newspaper world.
Well, there are, and the Seattle PI was a Hearst newspaper.
That's
other
right.
Hearst companies have gone either partial or fully online. I believe the Detroit Free Press is a Hearst newspaper and is delivering 3 days a week newspapers, including Sunday, and the rest online. And it's some kind of combination of sort of these hybrid models of trying to figure out how to monetize the system.
Yeah, you're seeing a lot of these legacy print publications try to find these new models in the online world. I think the thing that surprised me about the Times announcement was that there wasn't a effort to provide additional value, or at least a statement of an effort to provide additional value beyond what people are already getting for free. I've we're sitting here at an NPR station. I've kind of felt like, when I read it, I kind of felt like, hey, you know, give me a tote bag at least, you know. But
you're getting the news. What are you talking about?
Right, but the value that's been placed on that news, right or wrong, for the past decade or more, has been free online, and so that's what's locked into consumers' minds. So it will be a challenge for them to overcome that.
But at some point in time, ever since your newspaper, the PI, folded, and before that, as we saw increasing outlets for journalism or alternative, like GeekWire, alternative platforms for journalism, the traditional outlets have been trying to figure out, how do we deliver a product that many people believe is important for democracy to have
absolutely.
A daily newspaper? But how do we not only deliver the product, but how do we actually pay for delivering this product? And I know it's not quite the same model as we are a 501c3 licensed to an educational organization, but it's a similar kind of conundrum.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are some lessons for newspapers from just general tech companies. And one model that has really seemed to work for startups over the past few years has been what they call freemium.
Hmm.
So you offer your service for free to upwards of 90% of your customers, and you make your money on 10%. And that really is, in part, what the Times is going to be doing with its online model.
Well, that's sort of, you're talking about also the social media sites like LinkedIn or...
Absolutely. And video games, too. You know, a lot of these games are what they call free to play, and then you basically can have a better experience by buying a little bit more.
I think they call that in the retail world upselling.
Upselling, yeah. What I look for, and what I hope these newspapers can figure out, is how to actually create premium value that goes above and beyond the free content that they've been providing for the past decades.
Well, you know, the New York Times did that paywall installation after they'd been offering the material for free. Has it been successful for them?
You know, I'm not super familiar with the New York Times business model, but I know that they are not.
Well, I know I pay
not,
for
yeah,
it, but...
Yeah, and frankly, the main way that I've ended up reading newspapers over the past year or so has been on my Kindle. My trick is I'm such a cheapskate. I buy the Sunday New York Times because it's still 99 cents on the Kindle, and you get great content, more content than during the week. And then the trick is the most emailed stories, because then you can get the best stories from the past week.
And you get your 10 free.
Exactly.
Todd Bishop is co-founder and national editor for GeekWire, an independent tech news site based here in Seattle, regular contributor to the program. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Marcy.
Couple of corrections. Last hour, we were talking about Sonics memorabilia, and listeners emailed in to tell us that the Sonics were not the first professional team to win a championship trophy. The 1917 Seattle Metropolitans won the Stanley Cup in a series against against the Montreal Canadiens. And also, I said that the papal conclave convenes next week. They meet on Monday, according to listener Chris, to decide when to meet. But that was a date change that the Pope had to approve, soon to be the Pope Emeritus. Our program is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, and Andy Hirst. Bernard Ouellette is the man at the helm. Danielle Anthony Goodwin is our intern. I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scheer. Hope you can join us tomorrow.
Dear Seattle bus rider, you were riding the express bus, even though you usually don't. You got off at Westlake, but not before we talked about University of Michigan sports and how long I'd be in school. When you got off the bus, I saw you looking back at me. I would have liked to ask you to skip whatever you were doing and go grab a drink with me. That's a missed connections posting from Seattle Craigslist. Will those folks find one another? And if they do, what might happen? Maybe you have a story to share. Have you ever placed or responded to a missed connections type ad? Did you get a response? Did you meet? What happened? Let us know by calling right now, 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. We're talking missed connections today at noon. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from AEG Live, presenting the Mary Moore Park Concert Series with Pink Martini at King County's Mary Moore Park on August 4th. Tickets are on sale Friday, March 1st at 10 a.m. at axs.com. More information at Mary Moore.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.